Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, WFED.
Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest is Rob Klopp, the former Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. Rob, in many ways, this is a return engagement for you to the show, but it's also our exit interview, so thanks so much for taking the time.
It's my pleasure, Jason. Thank you.
Let me just start at the beginning. You were one of the few CIOs, probably the only political CIO, that actually stayed longer into the administration, the Trump administration, than most. I think most left in that, you know, January 17th, 19th time frame. Give me a sense, any reason why that you were asked to stay longer?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that the administration saw that the stuff that we were doing at SSA was all good stuff and that there was no real political agenda there that would cause them to want to move quickly. And I think they hoped that they would be able to get a replacement in quickly so that we could do a transition to their political appointee.
They haven't yet. When you left back, I guess, April 14th timeframe, they hadn't gotten someone to replace you yet, right?
I think that's correct. Herb Strauss, who was my deputy CIO, is basically filling in, and he'll be able to do that transition. I will say that there are rumors that there are candidates, you know, in the wings, and it may not be very long before somebody shows up. So that'll be a good thing.
And I'm sure you'll get one of those first calls from that new person. He or she will want to talk to you about all the things you've been working on and all the changes. So I'm sure you'll know about it as soon as. And we're going to get to the kind of advice maybe you would have for that a new person maybe later in the program. But let me start with just some, you know, you spent, remind me, about 3 years in the government. You started off as a Presidential Innovation Fellow. You worked at USDS, and eventually you ended up at SSA as the CIO. Let's look back on those 2-3 years that you spent in the government.
Yeah, I actually was at SSA for a little over 2 years. I did not come in as a innovation fellow, but I did come in originally through the U.S. Digital Services program. It was a really fascinating thing for me. It was always meant for me to only be there for 2 years. So my departure had nothing to do with politics or the election or anything like that. You know, my hope was to come in and try to see if I could be helpful. And, I have to say that the systems folks at the Social Security Administration are, you know, just remarkably competent and switched on. And I far exceeded my, you know, furthest ambitions for what we might be able to get done in a couple of years. And that's really, you know, the difference between my ambitions and what we accomplished has more to do with the competence of the people at SSA than it has to do with anything I was doing, that's for sure.
So walk me through the call you got to come to USDS. Who called you? Was it someone like Todd Park? Was it the president? And why did you make that decision to come? You, as you said, you're a West Coast person. You had worked in you know, several other companies already. What drew you to the government?
Well, I actually got a phone call from a recruiter for one of the big venture capital firms in Silicon Valley, who asked me if I had ever considered going to work for the federal government. And I sort of laughed and said no. He said that there were some important jobs, but he didn't really know what they were. And so I said, well, so when you find out more, call me back and we'll talk. About 2 months later, I got a phone call from him asking if I could, on a Monday morning, asking if I could be in Washington on Friday. I was on the West Coast. And so I made those arrangements, came back, and it turned out that this was sort of the preliminary kickoff for the U.S. Digital Services program. And so, you know, Todd Park, Mikey Dickerson, and those guys were all there. And about 3/4 of the way through the day, all of a sudden the door opens and President Obama walks in. He's a very engaging fellow. He kind of looked around at the 20 or 30 people in the room and said, look, IT is extremely important. We need some help to get this thing moving in the right direction. We can't pay you very much, but I know it's going to be much more difficult for you to say no now that the president has personally come in and asked you to join up. And he kind of giggled after that statement and walked out. And of course, he was right. When the president asks you, I'm not really interested. And so he got me hooked, and I decided to come sign up for 2 years. And boy, I just don't regret it one bit. It was a fantastic experience. And you know, I hope that the stuff that I was able to do in the couple of years I had at SSA turns out to be helpful.
And so you spent your first 6 months, first 9 months, maybe a year at USDS, and then you ended up at SSA first as the CTO and then eventually the CIO. Talk about that transition too.
Yeah, so I went straight to the SSA as the CTO. They were looking for a CIO. You know, I think that they looked at my technical background and came to the conclusion that I might be better off as the CTO while they were still looking for a CIO. And then once I sort of got in there, they came to the decision that maybe I should be the CIO after all. And so it was a fairly easy and seamless transition for me.
When you go back to that first interaction with the USDS folks, when you go back to the first interaction with the president, I mean, what was your background in terms of the federal government? Did you have any experience with the federal government beyond what most citizens have? I mean, you paid your taxes, hopefully. You maybe had some interactions through other ways. But generally speaking, had you done anything with the government previously?
So I actually started my career out working for the state of California in the first 7 years of my originally, even when I was still going to college, worked in the government space. So I had some big government experience. But other than that very beginning, I had almost no experience with the federal government at all. Even in the commercial space, I was not usually aligned into the federal sector. So yeah, I came in very green and naive, I think. I think the naivete was helpful. It let me, instead of walk in all spooked about the constraints, it let me go in and say, okay, I need to try to see if I can get some things moving, and I'll, you know, constraints are just something to be worked around. So I'll say the two things about the way this all set up. One is the naivete helped me. The other thing is, you know, having a 2-year deadline, knowing that I was going to leave after 2 years really, was important, because instead of taking on things that might have taken 5 years, I knew that I had to focus on things that I could get done in 2 years. And it changed the way I approached the job in a really interesting way.
The other piece of this, and you've been very complimentary of the SSA career folk, if you will, the federal workers that you worked with every single day. Did you have any preconceived notions about the quote unquote federal worker?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I knew that they had a bunch of mainframes, and I had early in my career some very, deep technical experience in the mainframe world and worked in data centers. So I was aware of the good news and bad news about what mainframes are all about. So I kind of knew what I was getting into there. As far as the competence of the people, I'm sort of embarrassed to say that I probably walked in expecting not a low level of competence. I knew enough from my work in the government to know that there are really smart people in the government. But I think I sort of expected a really, maybe a lower energy level. And when I got in, I found, in fact, these folks were looking for somebody to help turn them on to more modern IT infrastructure kinds of ideas, and that the energy was there. I just needed to unleash it.
One of the things you mentioned that I thought was interesting and kind of tags back to this, unleash this energy level. You mentioned you knew that you only had a 2-year stay for the most part. You knew you couldn't have a 5-year plan. You couldn't have a 7-year plan. Was that advice that someone gave you? Meaning you knew that you'd only stay 2 years, but did someone tell you, figure out the 3-4 things you can get done in 2 years? Figure out what are the small bites that really will have the biggest impact? Or was that just something that you brought based on your experience in the private sector?
Yeah, I think it was just something I brought based upon my experience and, wanting to have an impact during the 2 years. I'll tell you that when I started out, there were sort of three things that I knew that I wanted to get started, and a fourth thing that I knew that was going to end up being dropped on my plate. And my original objective was that of the four things, that if I could leave after 2 years knowing that two of them were going in a very solid direction that was highly unlikely to fade and go away after I left, then I would have considered that a success. And the stretch goal that I set for myself was that for one of those two things that I got going, that I would actually have some code on the ground running, that it wasn't just planning and aspirational stuff. And what I found was after a year, so, several months of being the CTO and then some number of months of being the CIO, after just a year total there, that I was pretty much assured that I was going to have code in the ground in all four of these initiatives. So, like I said, these guys really they really stepped up when I got there, and you know, gosh, it was just fantastic to work with them all.
So we're going to delve into some of those details in a second. But first, Rob, let's take a quick break. We come back, we can start talking about those four objectives and some of the successes you did have and are having at SSA. My guest is Rob Klopp, the former Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest is Rob Klopp, the former Social Security Administration CIO. Rob, this is part of our exit interview. I'd love to catch up with the CIOs who have been in government for a little while, and as they leave, kind of talk about their tenure. We just finished last segment. One of the things you brought up was four objectives, four things you hope to get done over the 2 years. But first, before we head down that path, what's interesting about SSA, and it's much different than most agencies, and I'm not sure you knew this walking in, is how SSA depends on federal employees versus depending on contractors to do the work. Talk about that setup and how it's so much different than many other places.
Actually, I did know that this was going on, and it's one of the reasons that I was very interested and excited about coming to SSA. You know, most of the federal agencies, I'm going to say almost every other one, has a ratio of federal employee to contractor of 25 or 30% Fed to 70 to 75% contractor. And those numbers are completely flipped at SSA. We have about 70% of our IT workload is done by federal employees, and only about 30% is done by contractors. And I think there's a really important advantage to that. It means that we have subject matter experts in our IT department, folks that really understand the business that SSA is in and have built these systems and have been around for all this time, as opposed to the model where you have contractors, which, you know, tend to not be permanent, who tend to rotate out. And so it's much less likely that if you use contractors that you have people in your IT staff that have 10 to 20 years of experience working in the space. So SSA, I think, has a built-in advantage. The other thing I'll tell you, sort of two things interesting about that. One is that, you know, it costs about one-third less to have a federal employee fully burdened than to have a contractor. And, you know, I know that there's this sort of a tension now, because on the one hand, there's a belief that we need to cut the number of federal employees there are in order to cut the amount of money we spend. But the reality is, it costs more to hire contractors to do the amount of work than it costs to hire federal employees. And so I think that probably we have to, you know, think about that balance a little bit differently than the way we've been thinking about it in the past.
So let me jump in, because this is a very important point you're making here. Many people will tell you contractors are cheaper. Many want to make the point that contractors are easier to get rid of. One, did this surprise you that feds cost less? And two, did you expect to when you came in, to have to bring in a bunch of contractors, and had your mind changed in the end?
I probably expected that feds cost less. I think that what I didn't realize was that the general competence of the federal employees is equal to the competence of the contractor employees. You know, the contractors probably have at the highest end extremely capable people, because they can pay substantially more than the Fed can. But, you know, in the sort of general, you know, workaday roles in IT, programming and stuff like that, you know, I think that the federal employees and the contractors have about the same level of training and background and competence. In fact, you know, probably one of the things that was a surprise to me is that every time the Social Security Administration opens up federal jobs, we fill those jobs directly from the contractors who are working at the agency at the time, because the contractors are happy and excited to give up their contracting jobs and take less pay in order to come into the federal space and have a little bit of stability into their work life. So, you know, I would never suggest that the right thing for the federal government to do is to go to 100% employees, because having 20 to 30% contractors gives you the flexibility that you mentioned, Jason, when you said it's easier to get rid of folks. But let's be real, you might want to have the flexibility to get rid of 20 to 30% of your staff because of the budget expansions and compressions that happen in the federal government. But it's highly unlikely that you're going to compress below that number. And so I think that that's the right ratio. I think having 70% federal employees and 30% contractors actually provides the most cost-effective approach for the federal government.
One of the things about contractors that comes in is the skill set. Again, you're saying that you felt that the people, at least at SSA, were just as skilled as the people in the contracting world. Did other CIOs within the government that you talked to, when you know, the friends and colleagues, did they offer similar ideas, or was SSA different because of what SSA is and has been, you know, in terms of keeping things in-house for so long?
You know, I think it is different. We've had things in-house for a very long time. I think the other CIOs for a very long time have been working with a ratio of, you know, 25 or 30% federal employees to 70% contractors. And so it's just a matter of sort of, you know, what you're used to. And you know, I think there's something important to keep in mind also about this idea of competence. I mean, the reality is that the contractors have the skill sets that we pay them to have. So, you know, if I, you know, you've heard me say on multiple occasions that we have 60 million lines of COBOL code at the Social Security Administration. If when I hire contractors, I hire contractors to extend and support 60 million lines of COBOL code, what they do is give me COBOL programmers. And what we found was when we started the DCPS-2 project, which was going to be very advanced technology using new programming languages and a new technical stack code and deploy on top of the cloud, when we basically decided to build that team out and use all these very modern best practice kinds of things, what we found was the contractors in the Beltway didn't have any more of those skill sets than we had. And so we brought contractors on board and had to train them in these new technologies. And that's not a criticism of the contractors. It's just a recognition that contractors provide the people to us based upon what we ask for. When we start asking for more of this advanced modern IT kind of capability, then they will train up and provide those people to us. But it's just the beginning of that learning curve.
You mentioned DCPS-2. That's one of your probably four objectives. Let's go down that path a little bit. Talk a little bit about those four objectives and what were you hoped to work on over your two-year tenure?
DCPS-2 was the one that I knew that they were going to ask me to take on. It's not one that I volunteered to take on, because when I came in, it was in the middle of, you know, a several hundred million dollar debacle. And, you know, we had to work through that. This is another one of these things where I think that we just, you know, under-promised and over-delivered. We were able to shut down the failing project fairly quickly. We did spend some time trying to figure out whether or not we could salvage some of the effort that had gone into that debacle, and found that we couldn't. We started all over again from scratch, completely modern, agile development using new programming languages like Node.js and building to deploy effectively in the cloud. And 14 months later, we were able to start rolling out into production a brand new system that's just been extremely well received. You know, it's interesting about DCPS is, unlike most federal systems where you deploy and the end user is either other federal employees or maybe the public, in the case of DCPS, the end user are actually state employees that the federal government contracts to do this disability determination process. And so it's almost like having real life end users who will tell you in no uncertain terms if they think that what you've done is good or not so good. And the feedback we have is that they just love what DCPS-2 looks like. So that's one of the four. The other three were, the agency really didn't have a very modern strategy around business intelligence and analytics. And so we started a project to build sort of state-of-the-art data warehouse that would allow us to integrate all of the data across the agency into one giant repository. And the agency had no historical repository of this stuff, and so this allowed us to start storing history. So we have now deployed into production a very large data warehouse that is, and it's actually starting to pick up steam. We have lots of data in it, and you know, it looks like it's going to be also a success. Again, code on the ground. This was the kind of thing that I was looking to do in both DCPS and the EDW. The third thing I think that was on my plate was we wanted to advance the idea of cloud computing and agile methodologies to build software. And so we were able to, you know, in the 2 years I was there, deploy several applications using the Amazon Web Services cloud and to put a volume purchase agreement in place that would allow us to continue to buy not just Amazon cloud services, but cloud services from a variety of other vendors. So I think the foundation is in place for cloud computing at the agency now. We were successful in implementing Agile and have half a dozen projects that use Agile methodologies, including the DCPS2 project, which used Agile start to finish and is actually a very large project with over 120 staff working on it, which makes it, you know, actually a very large Agile project. And it's just, you know, Agile just works. It's just a fantastic methodology. And probably if I was to, you know, even though I believe that I exceeded my expectations on Agile, I wish that we were able to even get more Agile going in the agency. It's just proven to be such an effective thing. And then the last thing, and in some ways the most important thing, was the agency had this millions of lines of legacy code. The legacy code was not particularly well structured, and so you could view it as a giant blob of gunk, 60 million lines of COBOL and 7 million lines of assembler language big. And the folks at the agency knew that they needed to modernize the gunk and, you know, really had a hard time trying to, I mean, they'd picked off all the low-hanging fruit, all the easy things around the edge that they could go, you know, pull out and convert to a more modern framework, but the gunk was just bigger and more difficult. And so the last and most important thing was we tried to find a way that we could take on a big chunk of the gunk and transform that into something modern. And what we were able to do is build a new data infrastructure that took a variety of the stovepipe old database structures that we had and pulled them together into a person-centric integrated view that crossed all of the programs in the agency. Originally, we called that Borg, which is a Star Trek allusion, but this is now in production and proving to be important in reducing the cost of extending the systems that we have in place and building new ones, because it means that programmers can write a single concise query that goes and grabs integrated data to pull into their program to go solve the problem, instead of having in every program that we write to query multiple stovepipes independently and then actually do the hard work of joining that data that a database just does for you naturally. We had to do the hard work of that manually in every program we wrote. So this last thing, I think we actually broke the code on IT modernization now at the agency. And I believe that you're going to see a modernization plan that Herb Strauss is actually in the lead of putting together that will be very comprehensive and will actually show a path, I think really for the first time, you know, in 20 plus years, it'll show a path that will allow the agency to start moving towards a fully modernized IT infrastructure.
All right, Rob, a lot to unpack there. So let's take a quick break. We can come back. We can jump into it. I definitely want to talk about IT modernization. It's a hot topic right now. My guest is Rob Klopp, the Social Security Administration's CIO, former one, I should say. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is former Social Security Administration CIO, Rob Klopp. Rob, this is a special edition of Ask the CIO. It's kind of an exit interview. We're looking back at your tenure at SSA over the last 2 years and all the things you've accomplished. And eventually we're going to get to your recommendations for the next SSA CIO. But before we do that, let's talk about IT modernization. It's a hugely hot topic. There's going to be a push, or is a push, from the Trump administration about IT modernization. And you've written a 10-part blog on the CIO Council website, which I commend you for because it's given me plenty of fodder. Talk a little bit about your approach to IT modernization and how maybe this is a, if you will, best practice or even a model that other agencies could follow.
You know, it's a giant topic and, you know, I could talk for an hour about it for sure. But I guess there's, you know, a couple of maybe three things that I'll sort of try to, I'd like to get across. The first thing is, and this is, you know, where I believe that a representative Hurd is just so spot on. And that is, you know, IT modernization isn't just a priority. It needs to be an imperative. When IT modernization is a priority, then it competes against all of the other priorities. And, you know, every agency has a mission. And IT modernization isn't really part of the mission. And so when you do a prioritization and IT mod is in there in the discussion, it, you know, it doesn't bubble to the top. And that's because it's not just a priority, it's an imperative. You know, we have to modernize our IT. It's not the kind of thing like a road or a dam that we might be able to just patch and keep it going for a while. I mean, there is infrastructure that we use to run the country, but in a lot of cases, it's 30 years behind the times, and that's just not acceptable. So I think the first thing that's important is to recognize that IT modernization is imperative. It has to be done. It's not just something that should be considered a high priority. The second thing that I would say that in some ways is, given that you know, I think there's lots of people that probably at this stage agree with me about the imperative. The second thing is, I think that it's critically important that we agree on what the results of an IT modernization project ought to be, because taking a 30-year-old gunky COBOL and running it through program that spits out gunky Java isn't really modernization. Rewriting COBOL into not modern architecture is not modernization. I think that there are three characteristics of a modern application that everything that we spend money on under the guise of modernization, there's three things that have to result. The first is that the applications have to be written. I'm going to apologize for some of the audience that this is a little bit technical and geeky, but the first thing is that the applications have to be written to run in a browser. Because if you write it to run in a browser, it means it will also run on a mobile device. And so all modern applications have to be capable of running on a thin client, on like a tablet, or an iPhone, or an Android phone, or a Microsoft phone. They have to be able to run on these thin clients. Otherwise, I think that the applications are not modern. The second thing is that these applications have got to be able to be deployed in the cloud. And that's actually a pretty low bar. You could take a lot of old stuff and deploy them in the cloud, but what you can't do is take mainframe stuff and deploy it in the cloud. You have to rewrite that stuff. And when I say in the cloud, I'm going to suggest that the cloud means that either it runs in a Linux derivative, or you can see some very effective cloud deployments that run Windows. But to take anything other than those two stacks, those two operating systems, and claim that you've got them running in the cloud would be too much of a stretch. And then the third thing, and in some ways this is the most important thing, this and the first thing are the most important things. When you build a modern application, it has to not just be deployable in the cloud, it has to be optimized to run in the cloud. There's lots of anecdotal evidence from CIOs in the commercial space where people are saying, gosh, I took my applications and deployed them off-premise into the cloud, and they're costing me the same or more money than they were costing me to run on-premise. And the reason that happens is because the applications are not built to run in the cloud. They were built to run on-premise, and the fact that you can redeploy them in the cloud isn't really the point. When you optimize an application to run in the cloud, it becomes scalable and elastic, and it's the elasticity, the ability to add more compute and shrink when you don't need the compute, kind of in an hourly window, that basically allows you to shrink your costs to near zero at night when nobody's using it, and then elastically expand it during the day when people are using that, and then to expand it even more during the peak times of the day. It's that elasticity and ability to expand and pay for just what you need that really makes the cloud cost effective. And that's the basis of how you use the cloud in order to actually save money in the federal government. So if we don't get a definition of what a modern application is in place so that we can evaluate the proposals that people put forth about rewriting this code and spending this money, if we don't get those criteria in place, we run the risk of spending money to take our 30-year-old Chevy car and upgrade it to a 10-year-old Chevy car. And I think that we need to not be going from a 1980 Chevy to a 2000 Chevy. I think we ought to be thinking about building electric cars that are self-driving.
It's a great analogy because I think people understand that. You know, it's one thing it's nice to upgrade from an antique to a more modern one, but you're still behind the times by 10 years, and you're missing out on, if you will, just to take this a little bit further, all the safety features. You're not going to get satellite radio. You may not even get a six-disc changer for CDs. So I think it's a good analogy. Do you get a sense that CIOs, you get a sense that OMB, do you get a sense that Congress understands these differences, that the definition is of what modern is?
You know, I wouldn't want to declare that they don't understand it, but, you know, it goes back to my comment earlier about when we did it at SSA around DCPS2, that we found that the expertise to use a programming language like Node.js and deploy with an elastic scalable framework like Angular or React, and to then actually deploy this in the cloud, that those skill sets don't exist. They don't exist in the contracting space, or they're brand new there. They barely exist in the federal space. And so, you know, IT modernization becomes a much more daunting task if you realize that the staff that you have in place that you've been slowly bringing along to code in Java Enterprise Edition now all of a sudden needs to be retooled to use really more modern tools. I think that makes IT modernization more daunting. And I think, you know, the point really of what I'm trying to say is you know, you have to take it on. You know, you just can't be daunted by it. You have to be brave and just go do it right. Otherwise, you know, back to the car analogy, you're going to modernize from a 1980 car to a year 2000 car.
Rob, let me jump in real quick. One of the things when you talk about be brave and don't feel overwhelmed and don't get caught up in the daunting task, how did you do that at SSA? I mean, you have a host of, as you said, 70% federal employees who maybe have spent their career working on that COBOL system or spent their career working on that assembly system. How did you approach it?
The best practice, I think, in the IT space right now is around a thing called dual mode IT organizations. And what dual mode says is that, by the way, this is the Gartner Group is one of the leading advocates of this. What Gartner would say is when we look around at the different ways people have tried to modernize, what we find is if you try to slowly and incrementally grow your entire IT staff from a legacy set of tools to a modern set of tools, it's just the process of getting the entire organization up the learning curve, it just takes too long. And that the right way to undertake this is to build a new team of folks that is totally modern. And so you actually bifurcate your organization into some folks that are doing everything in a modern way and the other folks that are still maintaining the legacy stuff. And I think that you have to be careful about how you do that so that the people that are doing the legacy stuff don't feel like they're being left behind. But, you know, some people don't want to move forward into the new world. Other people want to move forward, but they want to move forward at a slower pace. And I think this dual mode approach is really what gives you the ability to do that. That's how we're undertaking it at SSA. By the way, I would argue, even though I don't think we used those words, that the U.S. Digital Services approach and the 18F approach, those are dual mode approaches. What USDS was a mode 2 development shop that wanted to go in and do mode 2 development for various agencies and departments in the federal space. And I think the 18F guys would basically say that they are also a mode two development program. So the answer is that you have to go dual mode. You have to go find the heat seekers in your organization that are ready to be undaunted and move out with those folks first.
Were you able to do that for the most part? I mean, when you look back at your staff, did you, for instance, have 10%, 20%? How did it break down? Can you give me a sense of how you did that?
DCPS was really our most vibrant attempt to do dual mode. We actually took the entire development organization, both the business and the IT staff, and moved them into a completely separate building where we had space in cubicles set up kind of more oriented around the way people interact in an agile environment. And the act of moving them physically away made all the difference in the world. We've had also made an attempt within the sort of mainstream of the agency to break people out into agile projects that were sort of dual mode-ish. And I think that it wasn't a clean enough break. And so those initiatives were successful in moving us towards a more modern view, but not as successful as when we went full dual mode. So we've successfully done this. The agency has seen the results of it. And I think having now seen what happens when you do dual mode, there's a much stronger drive to try to figure out how to do more dual mode stuff going forward in the future around this new IT modernization plan.
All right, Rob, let's take another quick break. When we come back, we can talk about Agile a little bit and how this all fits together. My guest is former Social Security Administration CIO, Rob Klopp. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Rob Klopp, the former Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. Rob, in many ways, this is a great exit interview because your two-year tenure, you got so much done, and you kind of went through the IT modernization, you went through the DCPS. We've talked about that before. The other piece around this is Agile, and you've kind of talked a little bit about it, but moving SSA toward Agile, getting this culture change, if you will, in place, has been so important, and the agencies that seem to be able to do that really are becoming more successful in IT modernization. I'll just point out the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service is one example of an agency doing that. There's many others. Talk a little about how you changed the culture. You talk about the dual mode as one example. How else did you get Agile to be part of the way people think?
Let me say a couple of things about Agile that I think are you know, important to keep in mind. The most important thing is to be Agile about Agile. I think that the words agile methodology that's an odd oxymoronic blend of wording, right? I mean, you can't be methodological and be agile because the whole point of a methodology is to sort of constrain you. So I think that agile methodology should be viewed as sort of a way to get started in agile, but you have to very quickly be agile about agile. The most important thing to keep in mind about agile is in the waterfall process, what happens is we talk to the business end users. We usually, as IT and business analysts, work with the business in order to write requirements. Sometimes the business will write requirements. Certainly the business approves the requirements. Those requirements are detailed. And then the IT guys build a specification and an architecture, and they sort of walk that over with the business. And then the business says, okay, you've got the requirements. You've got your specifications. Now go do it. And then the interaction between business and IT sort of breaks down. Plus, you know, for a big project, it can take a year or more to get the requirements and the specifications right. And so you spend all this time up front, and you spend all this effort up front, and you have all of these artifacts, requirements documents, and specification documents that you've written and reviewed and approved, and then you finally start writing code. And there's a myth built right into that, and this is why waterfall projects fail. The myth is that you got it right. It's hard for the business to articulate requirements about a system that they've never seen work. It's much easier for the business to look at a system and say, oh, that's not exactly the way I want it to go. I'd like to, could you change it a little bit? And in the waterfall process, you don't get that feedback until you're at the very end and you're doing user acceptance testing, which could be a year or two, or sometimes even 3 years from when you've had the original discussions about requirements. What Agile is about is not writing requirements and not writing specifications, but capturing at a very high level sort of placeholders called user stories. A user story is not a story at all. It's a one sentence placeholder about capability that the business needs. And then having the business and the programmer sit down together and discuss what the business needs verbally. And then the programmer writes code and shows in a 2-week sprint and shows the business the code. And the business says, oh, that's close. But now I can see I said this wrong. I said this, I think, right, but you interpreted it wrong. Could we make the following changes? And in the time it takes for the programmer to iterate several times on the code, you basically end up with a better result in the same time frame that you would have expended if you wrote requirements and specs and all that other stuff, except for, you know, you're doing user acceptance testing every 2 weeks in these 2-week sprint things. So the fundamental thing about Agile is that the business is fully engaged, and every 2 weeks they take a look at the code. You don't write requirements and specs. You don't even write them, because all that matters is the code. And so the process becomes highly accelerated. The programmers interact with the business day in and day out, and you get acceptance from the business every 2 weeks, so that the end result is exactly what the business wants, because they've been tailoring it and tweaking it as you go. So the most important thing, in fact, the fundamental thing you have to have when you go Agile, is you have to have some engagement with the business. Now at SSA, because the business doesn't have a whole bunch of staff that are available to work full time on the program, what we do is we use business analysts as a proxy, a part-time proxy for the actual business users. And the idea of that is that 4 days of the week, or 4.5 days of the week, our business analysts are interacting with the programmers saying, no, can you tweak this? No, can you do that? But on the last half of the fifth day, we bring the real business users in, because when we work as a proxy, we probably get it 80 or 90% right. And that last 10 to 20% that we get the real business users to tweak is what makes all the difference. The reason DCPS2 has been so successful is because the business is engaged, the real business, the state end users are engaged every week in helping us make adjustments. When this thing rolls out, we know that it solves their problem exactly the way they want it solved, because they've been telling us all the way through.
I'd like to thank my guest. Has been Rob Klopp, the former Social Security Administration's Chief Information Officer. Rob, thanks so much for taking the time to join us and tell us all about your tenure over the last 2 years.
My pleasure, Jason. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.